Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. Do you think we're all alone, or do you think life exists elsewhere in the universe? Scientists and philosophers have asked this for centuries, and now NASA's Mars Curiosity rover is inching ever closer to an answer. Here to tell us all about this mission and some of the exciting discoveries that point toward life on Mars is one of the Los Alamos scientists who actually drives the rover, geologist Nina Lanza. Dr. Nina Lanza, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here.
So I've got to ask you right away, is it hard to drive a rover that's 10 million miles away or tens of millions of miles away?
Yes, it actually is quite complicated. It takes quite a few people. So I like to say that I drive the rover, but of course it takes hundreds of people.
Hundreds of people.
That's right. So we have to have people on shift who will do all different types of roles. So we have people who are instrument experts, and that's what I am. I usually am staffed as the ChemCam instrument, either the payload uplink lead or downlink lead. That means, you know, uplink is when we send a command to the rover. Downlink is when we get information back from the rover. So we need people staffed on both roles. And we also need a lot of engineers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory who will help us to actually command the rover and who will drive the rover with spacecraft commands. So it's quite an operation.
So when you're driving a rover, you're driving it toward what?
Whatever we think is interesting. That's the fun part. So
that might lead to a discovery of life.
Well, we're looking not for life per se, but rather places where life as we currently understand it, could exist. So that's habitability. That's the goal of this rover mission. So we're looking for things like water. Water is a key criterion for life as we currently understand it. So this could be either, you know, in the form of actual H2O, or it could be in the form of hydrated minerals. So there's minerals that contain water in their structure. So we know that water has been there in the past. And we could look for also organic molecules, those building blocks of life. There's a variety of things that we can and do look for on Mars to try to establish whether or not it was a habitable place.
Why Mars and why this site?
The distance from the sun to the Earth is one astronomical unit. And so we have 1.5 astronomical units distance between the sun and Mars. So it's a really close neighbor for us.
So it's possible to get there.
Yes, it's much easier to get there than somewhere that's further away. It's easier for us to communicate with this planet because it takes some amount of time for our signals to travel, so we don't have as big a lag. But also, Mars really is a very terrestrial-like planet. You know, you see pictures of it.
Terrestrial means it's like it's got a solid surface?
Sure, that's right. So technically, a terrestrial body is a rocky body. But I mean it even more. It's very Earth-like. When you see these pictures, you know, it looks just like New Mexico, except the sky is a little bit pinker. So Mars is a place that we could imagine going to. We could actually imagine walking on its surface. To me, that's
man going to Mars.
Humans,
sorry.
Of course, I would love to go as well.
Yeah. So that's a possibility.
Absolutely. I think that NASA is planning to try to send humans to Mars in the 2030s. Of course, that's not real until it's a line item in the budget, but I really hope that we continue to move in that direction.
So now this particular landing site, I'm sure NASA took pains to select an appropriate site. How was this site selected?
So this selection process was done by the Mars community. So scientists from all over the world, we get together and we propose sites.
So and what kind of science? All kinds of different disciplines?
There are people who specialize in atmospheres, in chemistry. There are people with all different kinds of expertise who focus their attention on the planet Mars. So they're an expert in Mars, some aspect. And we all get together and decide where we're going to land this thing. And we make a recommendation to NASA, who ultimately makes the final decision.
So the rover itself is about the size and the weight of a small car. And
That's right. It's
kind of amazing to me that you were able to land it at all without crashing into Mars. What's the technology behind that?
Well, it's amazing to me as well. So I am a scientist, so I didn't have any part in the landing mechanism, but the Jet Propulsion Laboratory engineers who designed it, I mean, they did a great job. It was incredible. This is something, you know, of course, we couldn't test before we sent it. You just can't test landing on a different planet. It's really hard to simulate that. So if you recall the previous rovers that we sent, they had a ballistic landing. So they didn't steer at all. And they just had these big airbags. and bounced on the surface, and that's
right.
how they landed. But
so if you did that with this rover, it would have destroyed the rover.
That's right. It's too heavy. We would have popped those airbags. It wouldn't have worked. So we had to devise an entirely new landing system. So the tricky part was that we had what was called the sky crane. And so this is a device that held the rover underneath it and fired rockets in the opposite direction of the fall, so toward the ground, to slow the rover as it was falling. And then it was going to gently lower the rover on a cable
wow.
to the surface and then detach and then fly off to crash land, hopefully not on top of the rover. And we didn't know if it was going to work.
Yeah, it sounds more like a movie than an actual,
oh, right?
Than an
we tell people this, we show this, and they're yeah. like, what? Are you sure? Like, is
but
that really? Yeah, that's the amazing thing.
Yeah,
it
wow.
was perfect. Mm. So
I know that you're a fairly recent doctoral student at UNM.
That's right.
And yet, you know, you're involved in what is an incredible project. So how did that come about?
I've always had an abiding obsession with Mars. It's unexplored, and it's somewhere that you could imagine walking. So my love of space started in 1987 when I saw Halley's Comet through a telescope. And that's the first time I realized that there were things out in space. In college, I majored in astronomy. I realized my senior year that if I wanted to study Mars, I would have to know something about rocks, because that's what Mars is made out of. So I went to graduate school first to get a master's degree at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. And so then when I was applying to graduate schools, I spoke to Dr. Horton Newsom here at UNM, and he is a co-investigator on the ChemCam project, which is run. It was built and designed and run from Los Alamos. And he said, hey, would you like to come work with me on a Mars mission? And I said, absolutely, yes. I didn't wait to hear from any other schools. So I've been working on ChemCam with the folks at Los Alamos since 2006. My main goal was to calibrate the ChemCam instrument for a variety of materials before we landed in 2012.
Okay, so this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have in the studio with me today Dr. Nina Lanza. Nina works on the Mars Rover project, and I think we need to find out what the ChemCam is, because you've referred to it a couple times.
Sure. So the ChemCam instrument is one of the 10 instruments on board the Curiosity rover. It's the largest number of instruments we've ever sent in one package to that planet. So very powerful rover.
And the ChemCam instrument itself, what does it do?
So it's actually two instruments in one. So ChemCam is short for chemistry and camera. So as you might imagine, one part looks at chemistry and the other takes pictures. So the chemistry part... this is so cool. This sounds fake, but it's real. We have a laser that vaporizes rocks. So how this works is that we excite the target at it. So we can shoot a rock up to 23 feet away from the rover. And so we've heat this material up to really hot. It's so hot it's vaporized. You know, it's hotter than the surface
of the
sun.
That's what the laser does.
That's right. And so we've excited the target atoms. And as plasma, this is what we call this, cools, and as the atoms come down from this excited state, they'll emit photons. And these photons are at characteristic wavelengths. So what this basically means is we can look at the color of light that comes back from our plasma and see what elements
are in
there.
So you're doing this from 23 feet away from
That's right.
what you've shot.
That's right. So we don't actually have to touch the sample to understand the chemistry. But so when we have that chemistry, that's great. But we also have a camera that provides us the context for that chemistry, so we can see if we shot some particular mineral grain or, you know, something unusual, so we can connect the chemistry to the geology. So it really helps us, provides us this context.
I see.
And this is an incredibly powerful technique. We can gather so much data very quickly because it takes, you know, under a fractions of a second to obtain one shot.
So now... You are presently at Los Alamos. Is there some particular reason why this is being done at Los Alamos as opposed to some other place?
Sure, yeah. Los Alamos has a lot of expertise in building hardware for space. You know, it's really challenging to build something that can survive launching, landing.
That makes sense.
You know, yeah, and operating, you know, on the surface of another planet, which is actually quite a harsh environment. So Los Alamos has this expertise, first of all, in the space hardware, but also in the laser ablation technique. So this is laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy, or LIBS. So we have teams of people who proposed, but we also have what we call participating scientists who write a grant afterwards. So after we know what the payload is going to be, then there are scientists who say, well, I know what I can do with this payload. Let me tell you what I would do with these data. And if NASA likes that, then they will be selected and be part of our team as well.
You seem like a perfect person to ask about women in science.
Sure.
You're a woman in science. So how has that been for you? Because we hear, supposedly, that women are discouraged from going into science, that there aren't that many women in science.
Well,
Is any of that true?
Well, certainly. I mean, the numbers tell us that even though geology seems like a very female-friendly discipline, there's actually only about 25% of PhDs who are female. And that's a sort of a depressing and low number. I'd say, you know—
But it's higher than one might guess, too.
Sure, right? You might guess it would be like computer science, where it's 2%.
Right.
You know, and so good, we're making progress. But that's, I think there are a lot of women who aren't going into geology, probably for the wrong reasons, you know?
So, but when you were following this dream, were you encouraged, discouraged? How did that go?
I'd say both. I mean, it's a mixed bag.
Really?
I was lucky because, you know, I went to a women's college. I went to Smith College as an undergraduate. And so certainly I was very encouraged there to pursue science. But I think the world at large is still not used to seeing women in positions of authority where they're subject experts. And I have been mistaken for a graduate student, an undergraduate, a high school student sometimes. That's ridiculous. Your listeners can't see this, but I have gray hair, so I kind of think it's absurd sometimes. I think there are people who still, just when they hear a woman speak, they cannot imagine that she has expertise. But that being said, I work with some incredibly wonderful and supportive men who are not like that at all. So I think it's mixed. I will say that I think science as a whole is still very unfriendly to people who are not outgoing and aggressive. You know, we lose a lot of people, probably men as well as women, because they don't want to have to fight to get their voices heard. And I think that's a shame because we're losing those people's ideas. And we need all the help we can get in science.
All right. So if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name's Stephen Spitz, and we've got to take a quick break, but we'll be back in 60 seconds. Welcome back to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz. What I'd like to do is move to another subject, and it's not one that strikes me as so obviously pointing toward habitability, and it's abundant manganese. Is that how you say
manganese,
it?
Manganese, yes.
Manganese.
Confusing because there's magnesium and manganese, and they have very similar names because the ancients actually had a hard time differentiating between them chemically. That's why they have very similar names, but they are actually different elements, yeah.
How did you or the rover find this?
Well, it's serendipity, right? So we get up and start our operations, and we have these panoramic images that show us where the rover is, and so I was actually on shift this day, and we had to decide, you know, what do we want to shoot today with ChemCam? And there was this funny little triangular-looking rock. And so we're like, let's just shoot that one.
You know, it actually works like that.
Exactly. I know. Sometimes it's like that rock kind of like reminds me of something, or I think it's funny looking. I mean, frequently we will have a lot more scientific reason for that, but sometimes, you know, you don't know what you're going to see. There's so much dust on Mars, right? So everything's blanketed in this
In this red dust.
Yeah. Right? So sometimes you don't know what that rock looks like underneath. You can't see all the features that
it actually has. Say shoot it, you mean shoot it with a laser.
That's right. So we used ChemCam to sample it from a distance. So this was actually pretty close to the rover. I think it was maybe on the order of 6 feet. So not that far.
So you shoot it and the spectrometer, is that how you say it?
Mm-hmm.
It shows you abundant, say it, manganese?
Manganese. Yes. Yeah, so
And what's so remarkable about that?
Well, manganese is a great element. I know most people probably are wondering where it is. It's right next to iron on the periodic table. It's a transition metal. What's really interesting about manganese is that it actually has what we call multiple redox states. So you can form different types of bonds, many bonds, depending on the chemistry of your environment. So manganese is a really good indicator for water conditions because it'll form different types of bonds in different acidity or basic fluids. So the other thing about manganese that's so interesting is that it's actually, because of its ability to form these different types of bonds, it's actually a key component in a lot of biological systems. You need it for photosynthesis, for example. So the most fascinating thing I think about manganese is that – so when you look in the geologic record on the Earth, you don't see high abundances of manganese at all until the rise of photosynthesis. So until we actually had life on Earth that was producing oxygen. And that's because manganese cannot be concentrated and deposited without a really oxidizing condition. And the Earth was not oxidizing enough before photosynthesis to oxidize manganese. So manganese in the geologic record is a cue to us. It's a clue telling us that there was a change in the atmosphere. So people have wondered, you know, well, would we see something like that on Mars? And the answer is, yes, I suppose if there were microbes. No, if there are not microbes and there was no oxygen. Now, when we see high manganese on Mars, I mean, we saw this and we were like, this has to be a mistake. This has to, you know, let's go back to the raw data and see what we're seeing here. And it wasn't. It actually was real. So this opens up the question, how did we concentrate manganese on Mars? Right now, the atmosphere just doesn't have enough oxygen in it to really do this effectively. You also need a lot of water to do this. That's sort of what manganese tells you. It's like a lot of water, a lot of oxygen, these two things. So then this opens up that question, how did this happen on Mars? And so I'm not ready to say, of course, that there are microbes that are producing manganese, but it does tell you that the environment on Mars has been very different in the past. There could have been free oxygen in the atmosphere. And what does that mean for life on Mars?
You know? So we've got to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a flash. So welcome back to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have on the program Dr. Nina Lanza. Dr. Lanza is a planetary scientist. She works out of Los Alamos, and we were just talking about manganese, and it's possible oxidization. Is that how you say that?
So really, yeah, it's oxidation state. It's redox potential.
So what would be a theory about why there wasn't photosynthesis? I mean, it seems to me like if oxygen here on Earth is produced by these microbes and there was lots of oxygen on Mars enough to cause this to occur, what would be a possible theory about why there weren't microbes at one point photosynthesizing?
Well, sure. I mean, that seems like a really obvious jump, but you know, for such a big claim, you need big proof.
I see.
And just seeing manganese in its of itself is not proof of photosynthesis. All it says is that this was a really oxidizing and very wet environment. So certainly a very habitable environment, but does that mean it was inhabited? We can imagine other scenarios in which, you know, abiotic, so non-living chemistries could produce a lot of oxygen. And that doesn't mean, again, we don't know if that's how it happened or not, but we have to assume, we have to always go with what's more plausible. You know, is life more plausible than chemistry, just chemistry? And I would say no. I mean, life seems like it's pretty special. So that's why, you know, this is a big discovery because it tells us something that's new about the environment on Mars.
Life started autonomously here on Earth.
Yes.
In theory, right?
That's right.
So, it's not beyond belief that it could start autonomously somewhere else.
That's
right?
Correct. That's why we're looking.
That's why you're looking, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't have to convince you, right? All right. So, there's been a lot of other discoveries that have actually made the news and the front page of the news, and one of them is methane spikes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's
and that was
super
just
exciting.
Recently in the news. So why is that suggestive of possible habitability or life on Mars?
Yeah, so this methane discovery is awesome. So methane is really interesting because first and foremost, it doesn't last a long time in an atmosphere. So it has what we call a residency time in the atmosphere of about 100 years. So that means when you detect methane, you're detecting something that's modern. It's a modern process. It's not ancient methane. And that's in contrast to something like carbon dioxide, which can last, you know, millions of years. So when you see something like, you know, see carbon dioxide, it could be old. It doesn't mean that it's new. So methane tells you this is something that's new. So on the Earth, what produces methane? So we have volcanoes that produce methane, and we have life that produces methane. You know, I like to say cow farts because, you know, we've actually noticeably changed the atmosphere of the Earth in terms of methane. The methane has really increased because of farming practices. So cows actually contribute to our methane, and that's a modern process on the Earth. So when we see methane on Mars, that says there is something that is happening now. There is a current process that is producing methane because it can't have happened in the ancient past.
Well, I guess what really fascinated me was that there were spikes, which would mean that – how does the rover – is the rover sniffing the atmosphere? How does the rover even know there are spikes?
That's exactly what it's doing. It takes little sniffs of the atmosphere, just periodically samples it to see what is changing or what's staying the same.
So what could account for these – spikes. That must be something local, right? Or it wouldn't be spiking.
So we think that it's local because of that. So it seems like it's local to Gale Crater, which is where we landed. But, I mean, right now we don't know what that is. We have our two options, right? So maybe Mars is not quite as volcanically dead as we thought. You know, maybe there is just a little bit of that volcanic activity and it's actually spurting up a little bit of methane. And of course,
I see. So coming from inside the planet.
That's right. So, but we haven't seen anything. We haven't seen any vents. You know, we haven't made any observations.
Yeah, you would see that, right? The rover would have come across. I mean, you're actually in a lake bed, and there wouldn't likely be vents there, right?
But there are certainly fractures in the bedrock.
So
there, you know, there are ways you could get these materials from the subsurface to the atmosphere. But of course, we don't know. But it really is intriguing because it tells us that Mars is not at all a dead planet. I mean, it's still actively doing something. And that's what this methane is telling us. And of course, we get a little excited about methane because, again, we also know that cows produce methane, not to suggest that there are cows.
Most methane on Earth is produced by living things.
That's correct? Right. It's a byproduct of metabolism. So it's not to say, again, it's not to say this is life producing it, but it's intriguing because it's something that is producing it right now. And one option would be a microbe.
So one more discovery that really wowed me, and that's the finding of carbon in rocks, correct?
So I think, yeah, organic carbon.
Organic carbon, right.
So that's
what, you know, a layman like me thinks of as a building block of life.
Sure, yeah, it's one of them, and that's a really important one. That's the one that all life on Earth is essentially based on. So when we talk about organic carbon, that's carbon that's chemically available to bond with some of the other important elements for life, as opposed to sort of locked up in minerals. So we have found traces of organic carbon. But again, like, where did that come from? What does that mean? You know, that just means it tells us that life could use that. Life could.
And how did you find where in a rock or in
right,
the soil?
So all of the materials that we've measured. So the instrument that made that discovery is Sample Analysis at Mars, or SAM, and mm-hmm. that's a mass spectrometer. And so it needs to have materials that have been ground up, then sieved for mm-hmm. grain size, and then that sieved material is put into a port and into the rover itself. So we haven't been able to do all that many analyses because that's a very time-consuming process.
Okay.
But I'm trying to remember if it was – I think this is probably from a drill sample. So the rover has a drill, so we can – it's a percussion drill. It doesn't make a core, so it basically just drills a hole. It's a diameter of about a U.S. dime, so about 18 millimeters in diameter. And so some of that powder, we can extract that and then put that into our instruments that need, like, for example, SAM or the other instrument, Chemin, that also uses powdered samples.
So all these things we've been talking about, and including the presence of water that you've mentioned earlier, all sort of point toward habitability or point toward the possibility of life. Is there anything that points away from it? Is there anything that's been discovered that would suggest that maybe Mars isn't habitable or maybe there wasn't life there?
You know, I think it's very clear from all of our surface missions, Mars was absolutely habitable in the past and is actually habitable today to some extremophile microbes from the Earth. There's plenty of stuff on Earth.
And you could drop something from the Earth on Mars and it would live.
Yes, absolutely. There were plenty of things that would love to live on Mars, and we have to be very careful to sanitize our spacecraft so that we don't seed Mars with terrestrial life, because it would be very tragic if we found life on Mars and it was actually life from Earth.
We're kind of coming to the end of the show, and I'd like to circle back to where I started, and that is, you know, are we alone? Is there life in the universe? And, you know, please correct this question to the extent it's wrong, but I think I've read that there's hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy and hundreds of billions of galaxies, and we're finding more and more planets, in our galaxy, and we're finding more and more Goldilocks planets. And now we go to the planet right next to us, and we see that it's habitable. As you say, we could drop, you know, microbes down on Mars and they'd live. So, you know, what, if anything, does that suggest to you about life in the universe?
Well, you know, I think humans have historically always thought that they were very special, and we've always discovered that that's not really true. You know, we used to be the center of the universe. Turns out Earth is not the center of the universe. So it seems to me that, you know, if we find any evidence for life off of Earth, that means that there is life all over this universe. I mean, we haven't seen it, but the universe is a huge place, and the chemistries that are needed for life are found everywhere. You know, there are clouds of amino acids just floating in space, so that all the building blocks are there. It seems to me that it would be very strange to me if we were the only planet with life. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's so important for us to go looking and to find out whether or not life exists elsewhere. I mean, that really would change our whole understanding of our place in the universe.
I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I'd like to thank my guest, Los Alamos laboratory scientist, Dr. Nina Lanza. I'd also like to thank my producer, Jefferson White. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Shebeki. Special thanks to Lucien Sims. You've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are downloadable on iTunes. Search for Stephen Spitz, all one word. Archives of all my past shows are available at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.